Creature Culture, a podcast about the monsters, spooks, and nasty guys that inhabit your favorite fantasy settings. We're your hosts. Hi, I'm Noel, and I'm here to remind you that crab pots aren't just a recreational thing, they're a way of life.
Hi, I'm Colin, and my favorite skincare product is Old Bay seasoning and hot oil.
And today we're talking about Chiapta Bay, Chules, and the incredible journey of the Kishka cast.
I really hope that indulging in this peculiar creature variant doesn't come off as shellfish.
But first, some news and updates.
Nothing too crazy going on.
Yeah. It's true.
It sounds like based on statistics, it looks like we're getting a lot of new listeners. So thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, welcome. I hope you enjoy your stay.
Yeah.
If you're interested in monster folk, you're in the right place.
Yeah. If you are even more interested in monster folk, I would like to take some time to rep another podcast that's kind of a big staple of the whole actual play scene. The One Shot Network is going to start doing a live Twitch stream event, which will be archived on YouTube, called the Dungeon Dome.
Ooh.
They're going to be playing 5th edition D&D in a weird sports commentated competitive dungeon run kind of thing, apparently.
Oh, that sounds strange.
With wrestling promos. I don't know. It's everything I've ever wanted. but the big thing is, from the teams announced so far, everyone is playing monster races, which is super cool.
Now that's got my attention.
Yeah. Also, if you don't follow One Shot Pod on Twitter, it's run by one of the network heads, James D'Amato, and he's been tweeting almost nonstop about Cobalt's rights, which is a very, very important issue to both I and Noel.
Yes, this is very true. No one takes Cobalt rights or lefts more importantly than we do.
I'm guessing I'm gonna name this episode Crab Folk, but technically this would be Merfolk Second Edition as well.
Yeah, technically, but I think it's its own. It's like, what's it called? It's like Merfolk Gaiden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Merfolk 1.5th edition.
Yeah.
Merfolk Advanced.
Merfolk Advanced.
Yes, yeah. And then Merfolk Second Edition is when we're going to do some weird... What's that shark in Iceland that, like, lives in, like, minus 50 degree temperatures or something and expends, like, a calorie a day or...
Terrifying.
Yeah, that'll the I'm pretty sure in our map we have the only Merfolk actually outlined up in the absolute Arctic region, so...
I also want to cover some deep sea merfolk.
Yeah.
I love angler merfolk. Yeah, very few things scare me more than the deep sea.
Yeah.
I have a deep seated fear of them coming from playing Ico the Dolphin as a kid. That game terrifies me.
Anything that has to be kept, that has to be in a high pressure environment, otherwise its body just crumples in on itself. Like,
it's just no.
Yeah.
Just no. Sometimes evolution does wrong things. That was one of them. I mean, it works, so it's not technically wrong, but it's wrong. But yes, that will be the next one.
Yeah, so what do we have up first? I believe it's a Leviathan locale.
Yes, indeed. On our first segment of the day, as you said, a Leviathan locale, we have the Chiapta Bay, which is the main home for the winter phase merfolk, the crab people.
Oh, yeah, crab people.
Crab people.
Taste like crab, talk like people. Kind of. They're really bad at soft consonants.
Well, to be fair, they're bad at soft everything.
Yeah. But this is, this is going to be in the northeast of the eastern leg of Talzerk.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you have the big central holdings of the winter fae.
Yes. Which is the entirety of East Talzer.
Yeah. Much of kind of the satellite of that is broken up into smaller nations that, are controlled by trolls or controlled by goblins, etc.
Or the Orc Pasta Belt.
Yeah, the good old Orc Pasta Belt. I need to make a better version of this map.
No, please. Keep that in. I will never stop referring to it as the Orc Pasta Belt.
Oh, man, my terrible handwriting. Basically, the major port for the eastern coastline of the Winter Fae Empire, basically, is controlled by these crab people.
Crab people.
Yeah. And it is, it's a little peculiar, you know, usually when you think of what's a really, really good area for a port town. Well, a nice, deep, safe harbor, probably a lot of, some mountains immediately around it to make it a really defensible position.
Traditionally, yes.
And maybe, you know, one controllable way in and out by land.
Preferably.
Yeah. This is a little bit different.
Oh boy, is it?
Yeah. For one thing, the city proper, is, which is called, Chiacta Bay. One, it isn't really a bay. It's really a huge tidal flat. Like, a tidal flat is probably about 10 or 20 miles across.
Right. And for those who aren't familiar with it, a tidal flat is a very long, obviously flat area, which tends to have a sort of dampness about it, but at certain points during high tides for the day, water rises up noticeably, and it becomes a very large body of water, and then it floats back down.
Yeah.
And it's generally hard to live in, but not impossible.
Yeah.
So it's not oftentimes heavily populated. However.
Yeah. In fact, if you ever, whenever you're going to a foreign place and going to a beach, a lot of times there'll be these beaches that are well known for being these beautiful, like, couple mile long expanses of just beautiful beach. Always make sure you pay attention to the safety signs, because a lot of these places will have, you know, the difference between, you know, 3/4 high tide and full high tide will put you 10 feet underwater and wash you out to sea. So
yeah.
Please, always when you go to beaches you haven't been to before, look for safety signs.
That generally applies to everything, but especially in this.
Yeah. But in the case of Chiacta Bay, this creates, the crab people, they are, you know, they make their home underground. They've got a huge community of burrows and tunnels, based out of their family, their castes, and then the factional group of their castes, which are theaters.
I like that so much.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that a group of crabs is called a caste. I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be a fishing pun, but
yes.
Whatever.
You know what? It's good either way.
Yeah. I mean, crab people, you know, they're not going to be able to store paper all that well. They're probably not going to have all that much literature.
No.
Music and acting are probably going to be their major forms of art.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyways, so they kind of have, you know, most of the actual city itself is underground. But they get plenty of, you know, rock and that kind of thing out of the earth, and will use that to make structures that are kind of above ground.
Of course.
Or they'll, you know, make buildings out of stilts, that kind of thing.
One does what one must.
Yeah. But the big thing is that this makes them, in addition to being a very martial culture to begin with.
Marsh.
Yeah. It basically means that they have the full control of this whole tidal flat.
Yes.
So the two times a day that high tide reaches its peak and floods the tidal flat with about 10 to 15 feet of water, that's the only time of day that ships can really get inland, because you're not gonna be able to take, even a riverboat onto the sand and then load up a caravan and try and take it through, you know, a couple miles of wet, muddy sand. It's just not going to happen.
No. So the solution.
So the solution is that, on this, all this above ground that, you know, they really only use for, you know, constructing large kind of castle embankments to fill full of, you know, dried food goods, dried fish, dried seaweed, that kind of thing for the winter or for sieges or whenever they need excess food supplies. And the occasional seaweed patties they have going on.
Which does not mean a seaweed burger. Instead, an area where you're raising seaweed.
Yes. That, you know, might be exposed to the air, you know, probably half the day, but we got underwater the other half of the day.
Right.
But they have basically big, like, kind of, if you've ever seen a shipyard, just kind of big frame set up for ships to park themselves so that when the water goes back out, the ships just kind of naturally rest upright in these containers without having to beach themselves.
Right, which is wise.
Yeah. Which basically makes a kind of de facto port city for, you know, ships to come in and they'll dock.
Yeah.
And the tide will go out and the tide will come back in, and then the various, crab folk and kobolds that might live in the area and goblins that are operating these kind of enterprises will have these very, very shallow, wide barges that they'll bring out.
Yes.
And ferry goods from the boats to the actual beachhead and the marshes that kind of surround the main defended landing area.
Mm-hmm.
And then take them off to trade inland and take, you know, inland trade goods and take them back into the ships and do exchanges, that kind of thing.
Which honestly makes this a very important city.
Yeah. And I'm sure that the reason that, you know, say, all of these crab folk weren't just cleared out to drop some sea trolls in or what have you, is that, you know, one, they're fiercely territorial.
Oh, absolutely. Vicious.
And two, they're incredibly weird.
Yeah.
And if there's anything that the Winter Fae can appreciate, it's a bunch of weird sea insect people that, one, love to fight, and two, love a very well-constructed poem.
So what you're telling me is that when it comes right down to it, the Winter Fae are Portland.
Kind of.
You know what? I'm okay with this.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
That's, if there's a race that the Winter Fae are going to be very pleased with that isn't your basic humanoid Liberty Gibbets, it's definitely going to be the crab folk.
Yeah.
No question about it. Because they are. They're weird.
Yeah.
They're very strange. They're very non-standard, non-humanoid looking, and yet they're very intelligent. They're good at acting.
Yeah.
They're good at putting on a show. It's just, altogether, it just coalesces into something that I feel they could appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, especially, and probably, you know, they're probably one of the few kind of pawns that the Winter Fae have that
prawns.
Yeah, one of the few prawns the Winter Fae has that is just utterly dependable because they yes. know, you know, they're even though they can survive on land mm-hmm. perfectly fine, they like the water. They're yes. not going to come inland to, you know, have some kind of coup and try and take over the court or something.
It's just not in their best interest.
And at the same time, even though they're perfectly, you know, fine out in the water, they're honestly, you know, if you're a crab and you can walk along in the water and swim a bit, you're never going to need a boat. You're never going to build one.
Right.
Which means they can't go out in boats and go raiding other nations and bringing a war back onto the Winter Fae's doorstep.
Yeah.
So they're perfect.
They're the absolute perfect tenants.
Yeah. And yeah, they, you know, they're more than content to help facilitate the trade the Winter Court wants for spices, treasure, artisanal goods, that kind of thing, back and forth between other nations, mostly through the kobolds. The kobolds are kind of the big traders that they're dealing with.
Yes.
And in the meantime, they just make a little money off the transactions and just do a lot of trade with kobolds and other merfolk and some of the goblins and orcs for, you know, simple things that no one really else needs, like coral.
Yes.
Obsidian. Anything that they can use to make weapons that will not rust and corrode over time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And actually, that's possibly one of my favorite things about this race, is the potential for them to have such interesting and unique weapons.
Yeah.
Which, as listeners probably know, I'm very interested in.
Yeah.
Like, stock standard steel and wood and metal and copper is all well and good. But I like things that are a little off.
Yeah.
A little offbeat. I like the scavenged weaponry. I like things that are put together. I like weapons being made out of things that weapons shouldn't be made out of. Almost improvised, but not quite. So that really leads me to liking this particular race and species, because there's the potential for them to use coral as weaponry.
Yeah.
And anyone who's ever had to handle coral knows it is fucking deadly.
Yeah.
It will cut your hands open and it will bleed you right there.
Yeah.
Used against anything that doesn't have a metal armor on, coral is a dangerous, dangerous weapon.
Yeah.
And even if it breaks, it's only more deadly because of it, much like glass. So I find that it's, for an underwater civilization, coral is a wonderful natural thing.
Yeah.
It can be used for building, especially if you have a hard carapace that it can't hurt.
Yeah.
It can be used for weaponry. It can be used for art. Is just the ultimate form of expression.
Yeah.
Another one that I'm very fond of is cultivating barnacles on your weapons. Because barnacles are the same way.
Yeah.
Sometimes more deadly. Smaller and less common, but just touching one of those will hurt.
I'm sure barnacle armor is, you know, definitely the members of Crabfolk cast that specifically are professional warriors
yes.
are probably actively cultivating barnacles onto their shells itself.
Oh, absolutely. No question. That's whatever downside it may bring. It is completely offset by not only the defensive, but the offensive capability it brings.
Yeah.
If nothing else, just growing barnacles on your claw. Just yeah. your big punching claw. So that's one of the reasons I'm quite fond of these guys.
Yeah. And it also brings up, you know, if anyone has discovered stainless steel at this point,
mm-hmm.
Generally stainless steel wasn't really acknowledged until the early 1800s. In real meat space.
Yes.
And that's mostly just because it took a while for chemistry to identify metals that had the proper qualities to alloy with steel to make something that would be anti-corrosive.
Yes.
The big things being nickel and chromium. But I'm sure that a race that requires a lot of trading is going to encounter a lot of metal going in and out of its ports
mm-hmm.
and is going to quickly notice which ones corrode and which ones don't.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That would be something they would be actively seeking out.
Yeah. And certainly, like, copper and bronze are going to be fine for a period of time, but mm-hmm. in salt water especially, you know, you're not going to be able to use them for long-term processes.
Right.
But, you know, if they manage to get in contact with someone who has access to nickel or access to chromite or something, and they can get mm-hmm. them to smelt it into steel, well, those are incredibly valuable tools they can use to make nails out of, to make chains, to make locks, you know, things that you kind of take for granted that you need to last a long time.
Especially chains and locks, yeah. items of binding. There's very little more important when it comes down to an industrial or even just an economic world than yeah. chains and locks.
Because there's only so much they can take down into their own homes and these burrows and what have you.
Right.
You know, at a certain point, you know, you end up with your house filled up with your company's, you know, trade stock, and your crab spouse is screaming at you about how they don't have any room for their, you know, their fish collection or whatever.
Quite. Crab spouse. I love that. As a side thought, would it be possible to preserve things like copper and whatnot by rubbing them in some sort of fat?
Maybe. I think the big problem is that salt water, it can basically get through anything.
Yeah. That's what I figured.
Yeah.
But I thought it was just a thought.
Probably if they do bring in actual livestock, it's probably not so much for food purposes, but for rendering into fat to use for things like that.
Yeah.
And especially if it's, you know, if you're not talking about, you know, a bladed weapon, you know, covering a metal tool with, you know, tar or pitch probably wouldn't be a bad idea either.
Yeah. Side thoughts.
And to that point, you know, I don't think they'd be wearing a lot of clothing.
Not likely, no.
Yeah, being an aquatic creature, even though it's probably going to be pretty cold where they are, it's at least going to be consistent enough that over aeons they've evolved biologically to be okay in the temperature range that exists.
Yeah, that's just how it works underwater.
But every sentient, intelligent creature is going to want clothing from time to time, so...
You know, just a scarf or a sash or something.
Yeah. I imagine that they're, again, going to be heavily trading for things like this. But they're probably going to really they're not going to want cotton, they're not going to want wool, anything like that. But they're really going to, you know, praise, like, linen and silks, especially.
Yes. And as we've mentioned before, silk is the all-purpose material. It's good for just about everything.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, it's smooth, it's comfortable.
It takes to water well.
Oh, it takes to everything well.
Yeah.
So I imagine that would be a very, very large thing.
Yeah.
And to that end, they would have a fair amount of communication and trade deals with, you know, the kobolds who cultivate silk, and to some extent, perhaps the gnolls.
Yeah. They might even have some far-reaching trade contacts that go all the way to the jungle.
Absolutely. That would not be uncommon, I think.
But that's probably mostly the winter phase trade neck. That's probably mostly just the far-reaching nature of the Winterface trade network. Just kind of flexing its muscles.
The East Fay Trading Company.
Yeah. Some, you know, they can get whatever they want in the heart of the Fay Kingdom, and someone there has to realize that they've got some money that can be made taking this stuff down to this one major port that they have and selling it to the locals.
Right. And it's going to happen, because there's a near infinite amount of Fay in the Fay Kingdom.
But yeah, I think another interesting thing is probably what they do for food and that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah?
Because, you know, crustaceans are mostly, they're generally scavengers hedging on carnivore over omnivore, but they'll basically eat anything.
Yeah.
But they eat a lot of meat, a lot of dead fish, that kind of stuff. They'll hunt smaller krill.
Yes.
Basically any living creature that's smaller than them.
Right.
But, you know, these, the crab folk, they are probably very, very aware of, you know, their sedentary nature. The tidal flat itself probably doesn't have a lot of resources to it.
Not so much.
Yeah. So, they have, you know, aside from what little farming they can do of hydroponics and that kind of stuff in the flat, and what resources they can get, be it, you know, small fowl or frogs or different herbs and that kind of stuff from the marshes.
Yeah.
They definitely probably have to go out into the ocean to fish a lot.
Certainly.
And it just takes one blockade to shut them off from their major protein source.
Yes.
So I would imagine that they do a lot of drying and preserving of food.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, even if it's not likely that someone's going to blockade them, that's still a thing you do.
Yeah. So probably the many kind of towers and small castles that dot the tidal plain are probably, you know, the kind of outer perimeter of them is meant for guard duty. People, you know, sighting boats coming in, you know, encampments at the top to, you know, have ballista and crossbows set up, that kind of thing.
Yes.
But the centers are probably entirely filled with stockpiled dried fish and dried fruit and that kind of thing.
And the occasional section specifically for visitors.
Yes.
Actually, as an aside, going back to what we were talking about earlier, their food habits, they are one of the very few creatures who can match a gnoll in eating disgusting shit.
Certainly, probably, you know, they can't, you know, digest a bicycle like a gnoll probably would. But
no, but
they aren't the tiger sharks of the sea.
Right. But when it comes down to the biological stuff, they'll eat the same rotten crap that a gnoll will.
Yeah.
So just as an aside for when you're thinking about that.
Yeah. Well, the good part is most of the food they're getting is already pre-salt aged, most likely.
Yes. So they don't have to.
Yeah.
But if it comes right down to it, a dead whale that's been on the bottom of the ocean floor for about a month isn't bad.
Yeah. But to that point, I am pretty sure that wood, in addition to, you know, being a very easy thing to take, you know, whole logs, whole trees to make supports for lifted buildings, is also highly prized for making containers to preserve food underground in. Because, you know, their homes in, like, these, you know, tunnels and chasms and catacombs and stuff are, under a certain point, going to be completely submerged in water just from the water table.
Certainly.
Which means that, you know, for dried food to still stay dry and last for a lot longer, it means it needs to not come in contact with water.
Traditionally.
So, do you know how a barrel keeps the liquid inside of it from coming out?
I always just assumed it was magic.
What happens is that, and if you know anyone who works at a brewery or a winery or something, you might have heard them complaining about soaking a barrel or what have you.
I've heard the phrase, but I always thought it was just someone bullshitting me.
Basically, how the barrel works is the slats are trapezoid shapes. So, you fill the barrel full of water and you let the slats of the barrel soak up that liquid, which causes them to expand. And as they expand out, the wider section on the outside puts pressure on the other slats, which makes it watertight. So the moister the slats are, the less can actually get through the barrel. So I imagine that these industrious crab folk would find out a way to make it work the other way around, where these barrels get soaked from water from the outside and won't let water into the barrel.
Okay, hold on. Are we slat shaming here?
Maybe. I imagine they might have to line the inside with an oil cloth or something, but, you know, any good crab folk caste will have their own personal supply of food buried down at the bottom of their home.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because who wouldn't, yeah. Honestly?
The one thing I can't figure out is what they would drink.
I mean, why mess with a good thing, grog?
That's true. There's probably enough, I don't know, they're up far pretty north, so sugar cane isn't going to be a thing. They'll have to trade for that.
Yes.
But, I mean, you know, a big reason for the American Revolution was trading for sugar cane.
Yeah. I mean, it's either that or potato vodka.
Potatoes would probably be a fair item inland. You know, they're going to be too far north for bees to be super prevalent, so honey's not going to be a thing.
Right.
Maybe there's some grapes and vineyards and that kind of stuff. Maybe cider would probably be a pretty big thing.
Definitely cider.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's always a big thing. And like I said, I feel like bees would be more of a summer court thing.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's kind of the crazy thing. Like, most of the time when cultures start making alcohol, it's to make potable water.
Mm-hmm.
I think crab folk might be one of the few instances of a race making liquor entirely to get drunk, because they can drink salt water.
Yep.
It's really not an issue for them.
It's really not. One of the very few races in which food is more important than water.
Yeah. Ironically, despite them having all this salt readily available, the climate they're in isn't in the salt belt. Which is the temperature region that is well known for making the perfect cured hams and meats. So yeah, if you look at, you know, the big salt pork towns of the world, you know, Surrey, Virginia, Naples, Italy, southern Spain, that kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
They're all along the same kind of latitude belt.
I legitimately had never noticed that.
It's something that I recently learned when I was looking into making my own cured pork.
Well, all right.
Which is, you know, a very common thing to do, I guess.
Yeah, it is. Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
Just very, very common.
But yeah, they'd be a bit too far north for that. So I imagine they'd actually be, you know, doing most of their meat curing and vegetable curing with smoking.
All right, just imagine pickling.
I do love a pickle.
You know I love a pickle.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if anyone's caught on yet, but there is a significant Japanese influence on this. And Japan traditionally loves a pickle. Certainly when you think of the typical pickle, it's usually pickled cucumbers.
Oh, yeah.
If you're lucky and you live in the southeastern United States, maybe you've had pickled green tomato.
Cukes, man. Pickled cukes.
Maybe you've had a pickled onion or a pickled egg.
Those are... pickled onions are edible.
Yeah, but...
but they're no pickled cucumber.
Japan will pickle anything.
This is a 100% true fact.
You've got pickled cucumbers, you've got pickled plums, pickled taro, pickled seaweed. Literally, they will pickle anything and it is all delicious and I love it.
They will pickle pickling juice.
So yeah, like on the whole, they seem, you know, on the pretty up and up. You know, they're staunch defenders of the coastline.
Right.
They participate in a lot of very fair trade. I can't imagine they're gouging prices going back and forth. They're mostly just trying to make a small profit and get what they need in addition to facilitating trade between their liege lords in the outside world.
Right. That does seem to be their thing. They're the sort of valve stem to the winter phase empire outside of their continent. Yeah.
Especially considering they probably regard the kobold traders they probably regard the kobold traders with a higher respect than they do their goblin and orc neighbors.
More than likely, let's be honest here.
But, you know, they're every civilization has its darker motives.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have unlimited access to some coastline.
Yeah.
Maybe you've got some metal and magic item sniffing, domesticated lobster chules. You know, you might be maybe convinced to do the old fake lighthouse scam.
That one's absolutely classic, isn't it?
Yeah. You put up a big old hot lantern. denoting, you know, a safe area to pass through.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, it's amid a bunch of really jagged rocks that ships just crash into all the time.
Or coral.
Yeah, or well, this would be too cold for coral. Because remember, they're trading for all their coral with the kobolds, which their island is amply just surrounded with coral and atolls and that kind of stuff.
Fair, fair.
Yeah. So they're you know, actively, you know, kind of letting ships crash, and then you might have, you know, some skilled crab folk trained to send out pairs of chules that just kind of pick off the good treasure and bring it back. And, you know, oh man, I don't know who's putting up all those beacons, but obviously they need to be moved. We should really let the Winter Fae know that, you know, the coastline must be coming up a lot higher now. Those must be really, really old beacons.
And thus they get away with it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it happens in every civilization.
Because really, who wants to accuse them of you know, passive piracy and then have to try and besiege this underground clan of highly, highly militarized crab folk that, you know, they've got weapons that can tear up an unarmored opponent and claws that can crush the armor of a heavily armored opponent.
They're basically big death machines.
Yeah.
Everyone's just lucky they're not really aggressive.
Even those that really, really don't like their long-winded plays in poetry would probably much rather sit through that than have to deal with an extended siege of the Chiocta tidal plane.
Right, it's true.
What exactly is a chul, though?
Simply put, it's generally a form of pressure-induced mineral, usually clear, highly prized, many different variants of many different colors, oftentimes cut to put in different rings. Wait, spell it?
C-H-U-U-L?
Ah, shit, I thought we were talking about jewels the whole time.
Oh, no. Definitely, this is a thing you do not, like, if you're being chased by them, you do not want to be runned by jewels.
Alright, okay. Completely fucking different. Jewels are a sort of angry lobster slug illithid thing.
Yeah. Like, I guess they have, like, weird tentacle mouths, yep. But they're also lobstery.
Yeah, and yeah. They're very strange. They really earn the term aberrant.
Yes.
They truly are aberrations on this natural world.
Yes. Chules are they originated in third edition Dungeons & Dragons. They're kind of the aquatic monster equivalent of a rust monster, almost.
Interesting.
Yeah. As far as third edition is, third edition 3.5 and Pathfinders, it would be. Basically, they were in the first monster manual for third edition and 3.5. They were also featured in Stormwrack, which is kind of the big aquatic splat book for third edition, which, as far as I understand, is like one of the better aquatic splat books to use as a reference as far as, you know, things like how storms should affect a party at sea, both in fantasy terms and realistic terms. And, you know, it's apparently a very, very good source book for aquatic adventure.
I'd like to motion for it to be called a splash book.
Yes. Well, I mean, when you drop water on a flat object, it still goes splat in addition to splash.
I grant, but it
depends on the viscosity, I guess.
Yes, it does.
But yeah, I guess their big thing in the general Dungeons and Dragons is that they're a lobster.
Yes.
They hate people, and they want to eat them.
Yes.
And they've got paralyzing tentacle mouths.
All right, so what you're saying is they're giant assholes.
Yes.
I love it.
My favorite chules, though, are the chules in 13th Age.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, because one, it takes the whole hating people and turns it up to 11.
Oh, boy.
There are a variety of different rumors for how chules came to be. Some people think that they were some wizard's attempt to create living magic items that could self-replicate You know, spawning living magic item eggs that they could just get as many magic items out of as they wanted.
Yeah.
But eventually they kind of took the whole killing magical sword bit and just kind of evolved into a creature. And just are all about killing all humanoid life. Because why wouldn't you be?
I mean, you gotta have a goal.
Yeah, there is another thought that they are, you know, there were two wizards that decided to...
Oh, this is gonna be good.
Oh, yeah. They decided to compete to see who could make the most, nigh unstoppable killing machine possible.
Wizards!
And so they went to this island and they just bred a bunch of, super mutants and pitted them against each other to see which one worked best. You know, there's probably an alien involved there. And the 13th Age setting has a major icon called the Archmage who came and sealed the whole thing so they could never escape out into the main world. But, you know, a few chewel eggs float out and infect the rest of the world still. There's another theory that they're trans-dimensional warriors bred to take down the material plane. And in their home alien plane, they're considered heroes.
Well, all of these I can believe.
The big thing is that they just really, 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 really hate humans a whole lot.
And humanoids in general.
Yeah, just a kobold, an elf, it doesn't matter. They hate them.
Oh my god.
Which is why they have such a wonderful, wonderful, you know, ability names such as Fueled by Hate or I Hate You All.
Or my personal favorite, Exposed Brain Nightmare Aura.
Oh, yeah, totally. Because why wouldn't you have an Exposed Brain Nightmare Aura if you were designed to kill all humanoids? But another kind of interesting thing about 13th Age Jewels is they kind of take the whole idea of, you know, an aquatic rust monster, you know, a monster that's designed to purposefully annoy the shit out of adventurers, and reincorporates the whole magic item idea into it. Where, you know, some Chul eggs will actually have symbiotic magic items growing in them as an embryonic Chul stage.
Huh.
Or that you can take chunks of a Chul and turn it into, you know, a magical carapace or a helm that makes you see better, or sticking their claw on your arm and it's a really sweet claw arm thing.
Until you get lonely and there's not a prostitute in sight.
Yes. And, you know, I kind of like this as, you know, taking Chules and Rust Monsters and kind of fusing the two ideas together to make something that works a little bit better as not just something to annoy the shit out of, you know, the players in your party with.
Which is a noble pursuit, but...
Yeah, like taking the whole idea of a Rust Monster of, you know, not necessarily they eat metal by rusting it, but, you know... A creature that is, you know, has such a salty aquatic lifestyle that, you know, things are going to corrode around it. It's just going to happen. Its lair is going to be filled with salt water. It's going to corrode whatever they bring back to it.
The melee fandom?
Yeah. But also, you know, keeping the whole, they enjoy treasure, they like eating treasure, maybe they just like shiny stuff.
Yeah.
Makes it for a cool kind of... monster to give more intelligent creatures to use as kind of like a weird dog.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
I find the idea of Chules being highly intelligent to be an interesting one, and I think it's a great thing to play up sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think they're also very intelligent as, or very interesting as unintelligent.
Yeah. I like them at like that pig dog intelligence.
Yeah.
Where they're not super intelligent. They're not going to be able to read or write or anything, but like you can teach them tricks. When you say the word outside, they get really excited because you think you're gonna take them out for a walk.
Yeah.
Or if you say the word magic sword, they think they're gonna get a treat.
Yes. I'm with you. I like that level of intelligence for Chules. It just makes them kind of cute in that I will rip your heart out kind of way.
I love taking terrifying things and making them kind of cute.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly.
Like giving a Tarrasque a belly rub.
I mean, that's basically what started this whole thing.
Who doesn't want to give a Tarrasque a belly rub?
I just had to sit on that image and it's just, I love it. I really do.
It's a good image.
It is. It's a good image.
But yeah, you know, Chules are a relatively new creature. I mean... they're, what, 17 years old at this point?
Compared to, like, the original Rust monsters and the Bulettes and whatnot, they're pretty young.
But still, I feel like, you know, they could use a little more attention. They have made it into Pathfinder. They have made it into 13th Age. I don't know if they've made it into 5th edition yet or not, but I imagine they're quickly on the heels of that.
They ought to be, at least.
Yeah. Especially now that Wizards is apparently hired. I don't know if you all remember me mentioning the guy writing all of the really good guides for aquatic races and aquatic adventures and stuff.
Yes, actually.
But he's officially working for Wizards of the Coast now.
Well, good for him.
Yes. So I hope that he, you know, one, pushes forward a new aquatic-based, setting booklet, and two, Chules are somehow involved with it.
On the off chance that you end up listening to this, congratulations, you. I'm very happy for you.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's Jules.
That's Jules. And not Jules.
Although Jules are nice.
Jules are nice, and I'm pretty sure a Chul with a Jewel is a happy Chul Jewel.
Yeah. So, what do we have for our last bit?
Let's see. I believe we have a monster memoir. It's The Incredible Journey of the Kishka Cast.
Ah, yes, the Kishka Cast. You know, the crab lands are kind of separated out. You know, they're kind of a sovereign nation sworn to the Winter Fae.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they don't have a strongly centralized government. Gotcha. It's pretty much a rule of specific areas of the Tidal Flats and different aspects of the economy and the trade and what have you are governed by different factions or theaters, which are collections of like-minded family or castes of crab folk.
All right. And is it spelled like the caste system, or?
Spelled like caste, like you're casting a die, or casting a play, or you're casting a fishing line.
Well, that explains the whole theater bit.
Yeah. I'm particularly proud of that bit of wordplay, but
it's very good.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a cast-off joke.
But, you know, there is a theater, that while they're still politically, you know, supportive of the Winter Fae,
mm-hmm.
and everything that, you know, the Empire does for their community.
Of course.
They're more ideologically aligned with the Summer Court.
Yes.
You know, not so much, you know, their families believe in a little more bit of community support,
mm-hmm.
which might feed into the fact that they still support the Winter Fae. You know,
yeah.
it's better for everyone as a whole. They're a little bit, you know, probably a little bit less heavy on the meritocracy and inherited life dichotomy, a little bit more on the middle there.
Yeah.
A little bit more communal, that kind of thing.
Certainly. More family.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, maybe, probably the only reason that they're, you know, aren't immediately stamped out as heretics is, also they have a particular affinity for the arts.
Yes.
And in fact, they are well known for being kind of the head of the theater districts, the best poets.
Absolutely.
The best, singers, the best, you know, performers, that kind of thing.
As literally any fae will tell you, be it winter, summer, autumn, or spring, the most important thing is the arts.
Yes.
The art of swindling.
And while the Winter Court is very, very entrenched in developing their material arts, the Summer Courts know how to party.
Oh, yes.
So, while, you know, they're a big trading city,
mm-hmm.
and they have all these connections to different parts of the world, but the Summer Courts are just barely out of their reach.
So instead of getting to go to sweet barbecues and lovely block parties, they're stuck with
court balls and
high society.
Yeah, political backstabbing and what have you. So you know that in the Winter Court, there's probably some Dullahan or a Nixie, or especially probably their contacts a Kelpie, to be completely honest.
Yes, I mean it's only right.
Yeah, that probably thinks that there's some resource they can probably leverage if they get a little bit of contact with the Summer Court to get more power in the Winter Court. That they've heard about this small sect in Enchiacta that you know, really, really just likes the summer court way of life. That easy drinking, laid back, margarita sipping, burger in paradise lifestyle.
Yes.
And so they go out and they go to the theater and, they go, you know, we've got, you know, some resources, some gold you can use. You know, we know you want to reach out to the summer court and we'd like to let you do that and be kind of, you know, the finger of the hand of the arm of the winter court to try and connect us to the summer court.
Kinky.
And, a certain family, the Kishka cast.
Right.
Which are named for their mottled yellow, shells.
Yes.
Very reminiscent of the marigolds that grow in the marshes, right on the coastline.
Well, that's pretty.
Yeah. Also, you know, they're pretty good orators, but also very, you know, significant warriors. They'll be able to handle themselves on a long quest.
As one does.
And they're given the resources to go on a long journey to seek out audience and embassy with the summer court.
Yes.
And their journey is one of, you know, literally going across all of Talzard.
Yes. Just one coast to the next and back around.
Yeah. And really kind of the pressing interesting things of that kind of came out of this, because really, you know, no real trade came out of it. As much as they would like to leverage more summer court, you know, influence in Chiocta, it was never going to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, the diaries of the crab folk that went along the way, you know, they give some very telling insights into the different races they came across.
Certainly. Because an outsider's point of view is usually very important.
Yeah. Always gives a better kind of perspective on different small things.
Yes.
So they immediately hop on a boat and head to Rocker Knocker Toggle. And I want to say that this just kind of ingratiates the idea of the kinship of kobold and crab folk kind.
That's a strange sort of bedfellow there.
Yeah, because, like, you know, the kobolds, mostly the island is covered in, you know, sparse buildings, mostly vegetation, farmland, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Most of their homes are honeycombed down into the island and the mountains themselves.
Right.
And while they're not filled with water, it's very similar to the way that the crab folk have their homes and their domiciles kind of laid out.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. What do you think probably the most alien thing about Rocker Knocker Toggle was for them?
Honestly, likely the mountains.
That's true. They live in such a flat place.
Yeah. Just seeing, like, a landscape that wasn't made by your people has gotta be weird.
I remember the first time that I had a friend who lived in Tidewater, Virginia, which is incredibly flat.
Yeah.
And they had never been inland before.
Ooh.
And I took them to my hometown, which is in Piedmont, Virginia, which isn't even the super mountainous area like the Appalachians.
It's vaguely hilly.
Yeah, but they were just amazed that they couldn't see for miles and miles and miles.
As someone who was born in a mountain town, but didn't get a lot of mountain experience because we moved out early,
yeah,
and has lived here all my life, going to true mountain areas is so strange. So weird. Like, just driving up to my old hometown is... it's a trip. Mentally and physically, it's a trip.
Probably the thing that always strikes me is I, no matter where I park, I always put my parking brake on.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in heavily slanted areas.
Yeah.
And it just mystifies me when I'm in a car with someone and they don't automatically pull their parking brake when they stop. Because, like, we're on, like, a 12-degree incline. What if your car starts to move?
Yeah, no, it's ingrained for a lot of folks who come from the places you do.
Yeah.
But, like, for me, I learned how to drive here, where it's flat.
My driveway was a 45-degree angle.
That's terrifying.
Yes.
That is legitimately terrifying to me.
Yeah. But anyways, for Rocker Knocker Toggle, obviously they don't want to go south to the Gull Lands, which is probably their most hated and feared mystical enemy.
Yep. Crabs and gulls don't get along.
So they head farther west to the kind of thinnest part of the eastern continent between the sea and the inner sea, which is, you know, on the borderline between the orc pasture belt and the general mixed orc, goblin, and troll lands.
Right, right.
Which I imagine is probably... They don't really like going through there.
Yeah, I get that.
They've got all these big, smelly green people.
Yep.
They're probably, you know, even though they're probably heavily family-based, they're very independent lookout for their own. They really don't have any kind of communal lifestyle. Like, they're trying to, like, go like, hey, yeah, well, you know, if you let us stay here, we'll help out around the house for a day. And they're like...
They just get a door in their face.
Well, you could pay some gold to stay here.
Yeah. And just not quite antithetical to their way of life, just sideways.
I feel like it's their kind of one, you know, kind of connection point is going to be on the immense amount of, like, honor and strength and that kind of thing. Like,
right.
When it comes down to, yeah, they're going to get a fight, they're going to get in a fight at the bar, but it's going to be an amicable fight.
Yes. It's going to be a fight where everybody ends up with black eyes and drinking together at the end.
Yeah.
A Scottish bar brawl.
Yes. The perfect kind. Eventually, they make it to the Inland Sea, which is probably the strangest thing for them.
I imagine.
Because, one, it's a freshwater sea.
Which just tastes wrong.
It does. And they probably don't even... They're like, oh, what, you have to import salt to age stuff here?
That's just... No.
And it's so warm.
Yeah. What is... Why do you people live here?
Yeah.
That would just be very, very weird.
Wow, I just realized that the Inland Sea is probably right on the equator for this world.
Yeah. It's perfect.
and to that, the majority of the sailors of the Inland Sea are going to be rat folk. And yeah. They've probably never seen something so hairy in their entire life.
Yeah. The closest thing they'll have seen is like... moss growing on something, like, yeah. That weird sort of moss that you sometimes see.
Yeah. Or just, you know, particularly old crab folk that's gotten some strings of algae coming off of their shell.
That's the word I was looking for, the algae. Like, yeah. You know how turtles will sometimes have, like, algae, like, completely covering their shell?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like that.
I mean, there's the, Chinese and Japanese mythology, there's what, like, the thousand-year turtle or something, where yes. It's got a mane of algae coming off of it.
Absolutely. Just something like that. That's the closest thing to fur they've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then it's just, like, almost everything on this side of the world has fur.
Yeah. And they probably think that the minute the first time they see rat folk, they're like, oh, these must be an ancient people, and then... You know, one of, you know, whatever goblin translator that's traveling with him is like, oh no, they live for like 10 years tops.
But yeah, just that would be something.
Yeah. And likely they're probably amazed at the amount of silk that's going through here. They're probably buying a lot of that. The Temple of the Moon they probably pass through, and that's got to be interesting for them because they've got such their religion and culture is so heavily, you know, tidal-based and moon-based.
Absolutely.
That they bring an entirely different kind of perspective to that, to the Temple of the Moon being in an inland sea where there isn't really a heavy tide.
Right. Probably, it would probably actually reinforce a lot of their beliefs that, yeah. Like, even in somewhere so unaffected by the moon, there's still a whole temple devoted to it. It yeah. Just only goes to prove the greatness of that celestial object.
I do believe the idea of were-creatures would be completely alien to them, though.
Yes.
Because when a were-shark bites a crustacean, it probably just crushes the entire limb. There's nothing left to get infected.
Yeah.
So they really don't have probably an incidence of you know, were-sharks or were-anything else.
It's true.
But to that point, the idea that the moon can touch a creature in such a way that probably at this point, you know, several of them probably get inducted into some kind of tertiary knight order of the moon.
Yes. I imagine almost a sort of mother of pearl or almost moon modeled shell would be something prized.
Yes.
If crab folk were to be born or hatched that way.
Yeah. maybe even a particular sign of high status would be mother of pearl bucklers, as not necessarily something to bring into battle, but something as a a parade weapon.
You're literally carrying the moon on your claw.
Yeah. As they continue on, they may or may not can encounter some orc trader, or as they continue on, they may or may not encounter some gnoll traders on the seas, or maybe some gnoll raiders.
Traders, raiders, there's not a whole lot of difference.
I think, they might respect them for the good fight they get out of them.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest thing, the biggest confusion they'll get out of this is probably the most sexually dimorphic species that they've run across at this point.
Yes.
Because I imagine that the difference between a male crab folk and a female crab folk is pretty much non-existent.
The shape of their underbelly.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah. Maybe in some feeders, there's a difference in size between the species.
Occasionally, one will have, like, little wispy fins and the other won't. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then there's gnolls.
Yes.
Where one is noticeably larger and more aggressive than the other, while the other is still really large and aggressive.
Yeah. But also completely subservient.
Yes.
And eventually, as they cross the inland sea, they come to the westernmost point of it. To Collarbolt, which is at least what they're told the name of the town is.
Right. Probably just a colloquialism.
And this would be the kind of combination Naga kobold run city that is the center of slave trade between the Drider jungles and the Null deserts.
Right.
And I imagine this would probably be the strangest place they encounter on their journeys.
Yes.
Just because, really, they probably have no concept of slavery whatsoever.
There's no purpose in taking slaves if they can't work where you work.
Yeah. I mean, they're so entrenched in their ancestral homeland. The amount of labor that they really do is so little that it's mostly just them moving and supervising goods going from one place to the other. And they're so family-based that the idea of taking a living being and putting them into servitude is just completely alien to them.
Absolutely. It honestly unthinkable.
And especially since their entire idea of monetary transaction revolves around consumerism, exchanging things for material goods, that they can barely get the idea of being paid for services, let alone for, subsuming someone's entire life for services.
Yeah. It, again, just completely alien.
Yeah. And if there was any reason that they would have disgust for gnolls at this point, it would be this.
Yes.
And to that point, they might even make an entire point of this might, their entire theater might, after this expedition is over, might swear off spider silk. And only focus on kobold silk, even though some of them might still be coming from gnoll plantations that use slaves.
Yes.
But high-minded liberalness really only goes for the big items.
This be true.
Yeah.
But certainly, I could see that happening.
But luckily, eventually from here, they travel northeast and hook up with the migratory patterns of the Minotaurs. And Minotaurs are really the point where I don't know how they would react to them. Because they're giant, and they're hairy, and they're strong, and they're definitely highly family-based, but just a mammalian cow people has to be different from crustaceans in some way.
In every way, I believe. I believe the manner in which they are the most similar to the crustaceans are the hard parts of their horns. And that's it.
That's true. I mean, the crab folk are highly, highly, highly sedentary.
Yes.
They, these families have lived in the same burrows they've had for centuries.
Yes.
Whereas the higher profile a Minotaur you are, the more wealth your family has, the less you're stationed at a single spot, the more that you move around.
Right. The more you're free to wander.
Yeah. And I imagine this is probably where their intellectual pursuits will come into, the fray the most. Because while, in various rat ports and that kind of thing, they're getting into physical fights and argumentative fights, they're doing more philosophical debate, and they're debating, you know, artistic integrity more.
Yes.
Because I imagine that, you know, crab folk poetry and plays are going to be highly symbolic, very terse, very deliberate, whereas minotaur arts of the same skein are going to be more flowery. They're going to be more illustrative. They're going to be a little more long-winded.
Absolutely. Very much. Minotaur theatrical and performance arts, I believe, would be a lot more for entertainment value. They'd be more for, I don't know, just recreation, I want to say. And I feel like the crab folk would be more for philosophical.
I want to say that the way that it would work out is that the intellectual aspect for crab folk art is going to be very deliberate. It's going to focus on connecting symbols. It's going to be about wordplay. It's going to be about...
That's something I can get behind.
It's going to be about, you know, going back to this ancient crab folk poet that specifically connected a local marsh to a certain feeling that they had regarding a certain life experience. And so things are going to gradually build off of that poem, even though the original poem, you know, barely hinted at these two things being connected. Gradually, over time, more and more writers are going to build on that idea.
And it'll become a permanent cultural embodiment.
Yeah.
You will always, when you imagine or hear of a marsh like this, you will always think or feel this.
Yeah, the Northland Marsh will forever be associated with the idea of love lost and gained again, or something like that.
Right.
And the more fun comedic side of it is going to be very kind of long and deliberate, like, you know, jokes that are kind of planted, you know, from play to play,
almost a dry wit.
Yeah, just, you know, things that are, you know, would be considered boring if it wasn't, you know, just, oh well, we always use this specific syllable. K's are just funnier. We just use K's for funny stuff.
It's so serious, it almost becomes absurdism.
Yeah. Whereas the Minotaur arts will probably be mainly made for entertainment.
Yes.
You know, lively comedy and slapstick and that kind of stuff. But with an undercurrent where you can examine it all together and see an intellectual basis that you can go, well, okay, we can look at these collection of comedies and say that really what all these are kind of themed around is, you know, the need for a minotaur to be able to roam free. That really the drama and the things that kind of stifle a minotaur are the things that keep them in place. And despite all this fun that these plays are about, really what the stories are about is making sure that people are allowed to go to where they want to go.
So Minotaur Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I dig that. I dig that a lot. That would be a very big difference from the seriousness of the crab folk.
Yeah, which would, I feel like puns would be very, very out of fashion in Minotaur society. But crab folk, if they want to tell a joke, it's going to be a stupid fucking pun.
Yes, it's going to be a brutally bad pun.
But when a crab aristocrat looks at Minotaur high literature, they're going to go, your themes are inconsistently linked. You don't have a good imagery system. You just, it's like you're just throwing things at the page and letting them stick.
And the Minotaur just sits there scratching his head. But it's funny.
Like, you're hitting on the collective unconscious, but just, like, you could do such so much more with it.
But it's funny!
And as they make the... Because clearly they respect the Minotaurs enough that they're not just going to make the short couple of weeks journey across the middle belt of the Minotaur migration oval.
They'll probably accompany at least a full half turn.
Yeah, because that, you know, they probably, you know, the holy city's about on par with where they'd probably meet up with them.
Certainly.
And they're gonna go ahead and go around the whole turn because they're polite.
Right.
And then they finally make it to the Minotaur holy city. Which is not just a holy city for the Minotaur. It's also, you know, the priest of the Minotaur also actively, you know, interacts with the local leprechauns. who are actively trading religious servitude for saucers of milk, well-made shoes, etc., etc.
Something reminds me a bit of Chaucer.
A little bit.
It's just the perfect, you know, the pilgrimage.
You know, my favorite Mark Twain novel, a crustacean warlord in London.
I'd read it.
Yeah. And this is finally, you know, they've met up with their first actual interaction with the summer cult, and it is the country bumpkin absolute lowest rung of the summer cult. The kind that never really even go into the fey realm. They just hang out in the woods and they have toadstool parties and play their fiddles. And, you know, the delegation from the Kishka cast are highly respectful and they have gifts to bring and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, definitely out of everyone, they feel like they're wasting their time the most with these leprechauns.
Yeah.
But eventually, they make it to the summer court. And they're finally able to meet and treat with Oberon and Titania. You know, tell them that they have people on the other side of the world. Mm-hmm. They're more than happy to visit, that they will, you know, put them up with, you know, they will wine them and dine them and play them as much as they want. And, you know, all the proper platitudes are made and, you know, trade documents are drafted and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes down to it, no one has the authority to really mark off anything. But, you know, some messages get passed back and forth. They spend some time there, ingrain themselves in summer cult culture and bring back many of a fancy gift that, their theater will probably appreciate for generations.
Oh, absolutely. Almost enshrined.
Yes. But yeah, I guess that is the great, fantastic journey of the Kishka cast.
As an aside, the trip back wasn't very eventful.
Probably a lot of the same. They mostly made it a little bit more speedy. They knew the tourist traps to avoid at that point.
Yes. The trip back's always faster than the trip up.
Yeah.
But as you said, that's the voyage of the Kishka cast.
Yeah. And that's also Chules, and that's also
Cheokta Bay.
Yeah, Cheokta Bay.
And again, it's Chules, not Jules. Just don't forget that.
Although I would love to see a dungeon named Run the Chules.
Yes. The Jeweled Chules Fern.
So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Mm-hmm. If you have any questions about aquatic crustacean life, minotaurs, goblins, whatever, you know, we'd love to get feedback on things you'd like us to focus on.
Oh, yes.
We're definitely running up on, again, we're running up on the list of original stuff we have to do in addition to, you know, going back to previous episodes and then bringing them forward. So whatever you guys would like to hear, we would love to know.
Mm-hmm, definitely. We enjoy covering what you enjoy listening to.
And, you know, by all means, if you enjoy creature culture, let other people know about it.
Please do. We really, really just kind of want to spread this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of entering another golden age for role-playing games.
Yes.
Where it's not just, you know, 10-year-olds in basements like it was in the 70s and early 80s. Like, this is becoming a wide-ranging thing. And... you know, you never know if your grandma is going to be really, really into kobolds or not. She might be.
I've seen Stranger.
Yeah.
And that's saying something. I know mine's not, but... but, you know, just let anyone you think would like it know. Just chatter about it. Do whatever.
Yeah.
Just enjoy yourself. That's important.
You can always find us at Creatura Cultura at Twitter. Mm-hmm. Pagetish and Nolbard on Twitter.
Yes.
Pagetish and Nolbard on Tumblr.
Yes.
Creature Culture on Tumblr.
Yep. I'm a lot more active on Tumblr than I am anywhere else.
Yeah. I'm a lot more active on Twitter than I am on anywhere else. Anonymous asks are always open on creatureculture.tumblr.com/ask. Mm-hmm. So even if, you know, you're concerned about letting your online persona get leaked out to everyone, or even if you want to do a named ask, but you don't want us to, like, you know, read your name on the internet, that's fine too. Just let us know.
We try to be respectful.
Yes.
And believe me, I understand the whole not wanting your persona out thing.
One of us does go by their real, actual given name, and one of us goes by the name Nolbard.
This be true.
But yeah, I hope you guys have a wonderful, wonderful next 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so if you were a crustacean man,
yes.
What would your favorite fish to eat be?
Perch.
Perch? Really? Perch?
Mm-hmm.
That's, man, I don't know if I know anyone whose favorite. Why do you like perch so much?
Because I like sitting.
God damn it. Here I am, a goddamn fish connoisseur, and you're gonna be goddamn punny.
Yes.